Blog Talk Radio.
Sorry.
Blog Talk Radio.
Friend of Kamal's, and therefore friend of mine. So I think she likes to hang out in the
the lower end of the gene pool to hang out with us.
Well, first of all, I thought you were talking about me until you got to the part about expert on co-parenting. So, well, you know.
Right.
Birds of a feather flock together.
And we have some other guests that are going to be calling in to speak on these subjects. So let's get into it. But before we get started, I want to start tonight's episode. In case you all didn't know, it's only been on the media all day long and part of yesterday. Today is the anniversary, the one-year anniversary of the end of Osama bin Laden as a human being on this planet. That's right. A year ago today, our president ordered Naval SEAL Team 6 to enter Pakistan and execute a raid on Osama bin Laden's compound in Pakistan and end him, plain and simple, end him. America's heated enemy, public enemy number one, responsible for not only the 2,000 lives that were lost in the World Trade Center attack on 9/11, but countless other deaths, including the attack on the USS Cole, the attack on the American embassies around the world, and financier of the Al-Qaeda terrorist group and Taliban political party in Afghanistan. One of the interesting things I find about this anniversary is the presumptive Republican nominee to run against Obama this year, Mittens Romney, feels, and a lot of the people in that party feel, it is an unfair advantage for President Obama to tout the anniversary of this highly successful raid and execution of this man, and that the allegations are that he's using this anniversary as political clout and making it a political issue. I think that's a fair and valid statement, and I think it's also a fair and valid point for President Obama to do so. For 10 years, America was reminded every 9/11, every September 11th, of the attack that killed over 2,000 people, Americans and other nationalities, in New York City. The attack on the Pentagon and the plane that crashed in Pennsylvania in a field. How is it unfair for the president to use that, the one-year anniversary, as we lead up to the general election this year, to use that as an advantage or to mention it or to bring that up as a talking point, selling point for the success of his administration?
Well, you know what? Let me say something real quick. I think he's bringing it up wrong, if you want my honest opinion.
Okay.
I think he needs to stand in front of the American people and say shablisha and be done with it. Carry on.
Why is it unfair for him? Why do Republicans find it unfair for him to bring this up when in 2003, then-President George W. Bush was landed on an aircraft carrier with a banner bigger than an airplane behind him saying, mission accomplished, to make Americans believe that the war was over, the war in Iraq was over, which was a war that we really, as an American, as a country, did not need to fight to go after the people who attacked us on September 11th, and use that and the unprovable negative that no attacks were happening since 9/11 every year on September 11th to show how strong they were in defense, to one, be elected for the first time in 2004, because I, along with a lot of other people, do not agree that President George W. Bush was ever elected in 2000. He was selected by the Supreme Court. But why is it unfair for Obama's administration to say that in Bush's administration gets a free pass?
Well, we all know why. I mean, if we're being honest. But the bottom line is, if you want to criticize him about all the wrong his administration has done, then you have to give him credit for the right. And they're unwilling to do that, and that's just the bottom line. And I would actually like to open this up to Ed, because I believe he has an opinion on it, a strong one. On the call with us is Ed Brown, a friend of mine. He hates labels, but if I had to label him, I would label him an independent conservative, and I always find his take on politics in the country and around the world, actually, very interesting. Ed, do you have anything you would like to add to this particular conversation?
Hey, thanks for letting me on. Actually, I do. I kind of agree with you. I really don't agree with how he's doing it. I think, you know, if the debate came up or comes up and, you know, you want to say foreign policy, then you can say, hey, on foreign policy, you know, how can they say I'm weak? You know, we did the things to bring down Bin Laden. We're using the drones instead of military members to take out terrorists in Pakistan and Afghanistan. And, you know, we're doing X, Y, and Z. You know, and then just leave it alone. I think if he wants to trump, you know, that we got Bin Laden, you know, that's what Joe Biden is there for, even though he's a wild card. And, you know, some of your political secondaries who can make this charge and, you know, and can keep you clean. Right now, I think he's coming off pretty bad. And I'm a person who, you know, who likes the results of what happened with Bin Laden, but I don't like this at all, especially since, you know, he said earlier on that he wasn't going to, you know, spike the football and brag that, you know, under his administration they got Bin Laden. I just think it looks bad.
Well, I have to dispute that, Ed, because I don't remember him saying he wouldn't spike the football about commemorating the anniversary of the event. We as a country, actually, we as a people across the nation, we celebrate anniversaries, or we commemorate anniversaries of events, good and bad. And to say my administration was successful in doing something that the previous administration could not do in 7 years, and the supposed administration to replace me was dead set against when it happened and said they wouldn't do it before it happened, I think it's clear that it's a fair point for him to say, we did it. We did it. The country's safer. I mean, and I know America has a bad case of amnesia, but I distinctly remember the weekly color alerts, beige, chartreuse, burnt umber, terror alerts that we were subjected to by the Bush administration, it seemed like weekly. And this, you know, whenever there was an arrest made, when they got Sheikh Khalid Mohammed, that was celebrated. That was talked about, not only in the Washington Post, but every major news organization, CNN, Fox News, constantly brought that up. So how is it a bad light for him to say we were successful and strong on foreign policy? How is it wrong for the president's administration to showcase the fact that without losing American lives, we have taken out several al-Qaeda high-level officials and operatives and kept the country safe that way? Why is that unfair?
Because I think if it's done in a broader context of foreign policy as a whole, I think it's very fair. But to me, to single this out, it kind of seems a little bit of bad sportsmanship. That's the only analogy I can really make to it. I wasn't around, but, you know, today we still don't celebrate, I guess, the fall of, say, Hitler. We don't celebrate say, the fall of Stalin, you know, or things like that. And Hitler was a pretty bad dude, you know. We do celebrate, I guess, you know, the end of the war, at least we used to. But I guess with people dying off, that's no longer as big of a deal as it is, as it was. But, you know, that was a celebration of the end of the war versus just a celebration of the capture and the death of one person in that war.
Well, we didn't capture or kill anybody high level in that war except generals and leaders. Hitler killed himself in a bunker, and the date of his death was, and actually the fact of his death was in dispute for several years. So it's kind of hard to say, yay, Hitler was dead on sometime 1945. You know,
and that's a valid point. That's a valid point.
But you do, as you rightly pointed out, we did celebrate D-Day. I mean, yeah, D-Day, VE Day, VJ Day. The country celebrated the end of those wars. The leader of the Japanese attack, the nation of Japan, when Pearl Harbor was attacked December 7th, which we commemorate to this day, Pearl Harbor Day, December 7th, was never brought charges, was never taken out of office or removed from power. So we didn't have, you know, that moment. But
well, Elvis died August 16th, 1977.
So is that the day you were born or the day you were conceived? I don't remember.
Just want to lighten it up a little bit.
Oh, but I mean, I do think you have a valid point in that it seems a little odd to celebrate it, but we have to keep in mind this was the most reviled human in generations in this country. And you're right, Hitler was a bad dude, and you can ask any person who's still alive that remembers World War II, any Jewish person that survived concentration camps, or any children or ancestors of people who survived the concentration camps. Hitler was, to them, the most reviled person in the history of this world. And I think they have a right to claim that. But they don't, unfortunately, they don't have a date, nor do they have someone they can say, oh, this person got him or this country got him. He was gotten by his own hand from everything we heard from in the bunker. But there wasn't that opportunity to commemorate when he passed away.
Okay.
But I have to ask you, when you say you think it's bad sportsmanship, is the best sportsmanship between the Democrats and the Republicans, or the best sportsmanship between America and Al Qaeda? Are we now saying, na 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 na, we got your guy?
And you know what? That doesn't really bother me, because if they got somebody good, they would be going, na 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 na, we got your guy. So I don't even care about, you know, what they think, because if they're going to go nuts, you know, and start, you know, targeting, you know, Americans or American soldiers, you know, they're going to do that anyway regardless. But I just think it just doesn't seem to me to be presidential. You know, if in the broader category of, say, success of foreign policy, which I think rightly for the most part, well, maybe about 80%, I think, with that and with the success that they've gotten with the drones, they've put most of the foreign, his alleged weakness on foreign policy, you know, that's off the table, you know. There
right.
still may be
right.
issues with Israel and maybe Iran and their nuclear thing, but, you know, the rest of that is like, okay, the Republicans have to leave that alone, you know. And,
right.
I never thought about this, but just think about it now also. It seems like if you were going to pull it, you know, wait a little longer. Wait until we get near the date of the election, so that, you know, now, you know, this will die down and you know, it's like a quiver that's not in your, you know, in your arsenal anymore.
Well, I agree with you, but the date is the date. I mean, we can't,
sure.
August, you can't say back in April, back in May 1st, you know, the date is the date. But it does, it frames the election and the run-up to the election in favor of the Obama administration. Yes, there have been some failures in foreign policy, but there have been more successes than failures. And there is a problem that I don't even say perception, but there is a problem from an economic standpoint that Mitt Romney swears he can fix, and that's a strong point for him, and that's where he should be hammering. But the truth of the matter is the date is the date, so we will commemorate it. If this was 2011 and he had killed Osama bin Laden in 2010, he would still, and the administration would still tout this is the anniversary date. It's just the date is the date. I don't see it being politically based solely as much as it's, you know, it's the date is the date.
Well, I think, you know, you mentioned Mitt Romney. I think even more to the point, you know, we all know what he said. He said, I think it was 2007, that, you know, he wouldn't waste his time and resources on doing this. And, you know, Obama said he was going to, and he did. God forbid a politician should do what they say they're going to do. And now Mitt Romney is trying to flip the page. Oh, you know, I never said that. Of course I would have, blah, 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 blah. I think once again today Mitt Romney has proven that his flip-flopping has gone beyond organic flip-flopping to just straight-up lying.
Oh, yeah. Well, did you hear his political advisor on the news last night said that Obama's decision to save General Motors in the auto industry was based on what Mitt Romney suggested.
Right, when we all know it's literally in black and white in an editorial, he said the exact opposite.
Right, right. Unashamedly said it.
Yeah,
he can give you, he can make anybody, and I have to ask you as a non-label conservative. Some of the things that Mitt Romney says and changes his mind on, as someone that considers himself conservative, doesn't that make you get the Scooby-Doo face when he does
yeah.
that?
I caught a lot of flack for this, but I really didn't like Bill Clinton because I felt that he really had no core and he would change on you in a die, or, you know, even on a speck of dirt. And I get the same idea for Mitt Romney. I'd rather have someone who's way to the left, but who's dependable in what they believe and will stick to their guns, or somebody way to the right who's dependable and will stick to their guns, versus someone who's a flip flopper because you just don't know what's coming down the pipe. You know, and with Mitt Romney, I just don't understand it. You know, the Tea Party had some success, you know, and getting some of their House members elected and getting some senators elected and whatnot. I think they, with Romney being the presumptive nominee, I think they pretty much failed there. And, you know, the conservatives in the, you know, in the party aren't happy. The team members, some of the team party groups are backing him, and, you know, that just makes me, you know, scratch my head. I mean, because it takes off the table health care. It takes off the table, it takes off health care. And that's some other issues that he's flip-flopped enough about that. You know, you really can't, you know, to go after Obama if they wanted to. It just reeks of, okay, flip-flopper, you know, flip-flop, flip-flop. I mean, I'm sure the Obama team is going back into, you know, and viewing the things that, you know, Newt Gingrich said or some of his other primary opponents said to bring that up. You know, I just don't see it. You know, to me, he's dangerous because he has no core.
Well, you're right. He has no core. But we all know politicians, and even Barack Obama has changed his opinion on and his position on certain things. But Mitt Romney takes it to a whole nother level. And he reminds me of the line from Hot Shots when they asked Charlie Sheen, when Charlie Sheen was selected for the mission, and he asked, why me? And the answer was, you're the best of what's left. And that's what Mitt Romney has become for Republicans this year. He's the best of what's left. When you have a Newt Gingrich who wants children to be janitors and work in their public schools to get their education, and let's not forget our colony on the moon, which I was looking forward to. I wanted a colony on the moon. And you have Michelle Bachmann. You know, if your husband's gay, your husband's gay. I mean, let's just put it out there. I mean, I have no problem with anyone gay, but the man was gay, and she, but anyway. But she was crazy as a bed bug, or is crazy as a bed bug. And my personal favorite, Uncle Herman Cain, Mitt Romney, this was his shot. He was the best of what was available. Unfortunately, Huntsman, I think, who had a better grasp on policies and had core values, as you say, he didn't really have a fair chance. I mean, when you've got Rick Perry screaming on stage, you can't remember who he is or where he is or why he is, you know, the sanity level, the circle sanity was broken, and Mitt Romney rose to the top. And God love him, I hope he can find a path and stick to it and let his path be his path. But I got a feeling somewhere down the line there's going to be a poll coming out that says Mitt Romney is 2 points behind Obama based on XYZ, and Mitt will say, oh, no, I'm for XYZ. I can see it coming. I don't know what it is or what it is, but it's going to happen because he'll flip like a pancake. He'll flip like a pancake.
And, you know, and I agree with you on that. You know, I really do. You know, politics lie. I mean, politicians lie, and they'll change, you know. And I guess we judge them on the ability to change and make it seem logical. But, yeah, he's way out there. And it just makes no sense to me. I think still think if the economy doesn't get better, President Obama's very vulnerable, you know, and housing just isn't going to come back. As a matter of fact, I read an article today online that said, you know, that they're pretty much predicting that when it bottoms out, it'll bottom out and go back to its normal pattern of housing increasing with the rate of inflation versus the, you know, the way that it rose before, you know, when it just like spiked and took off and all of this mess happened.
Right, which if certain conservatives I've spoken to blame that on Obama, is if the world, the time warp happened and all of a sudden he was responsible for the housing bubble bursting before he was elected president, but you know they blame the man for everything and give him credit for nothing. But let's move on. Let's move on. You mentioned housing. I think that's a good segue to talk about what's going on in Michigan. And we're talking about this today because Kamal was incensed about it.
I'm not even sure incensed is the word. If there's a word that is.
I looked it up in the dictionary. It's
the highest. How Robin Harris used to get it, the highest point of festivity. I think that's where I am. So basically, Michigan has a law where they can put an emergency manager. The governor appoints an emergency manager to come in and take over for a town, you know, township, city that is in financial straits, dire straits. And essentially the emergency manager will come in and take over everything and try to get everybody, you know, get the town fiscally solid, make sure that the important services, school, fire, you know, police, maintain their level of funding. And they basically can do what they want, but I think that has always been the unspoken phrase is within reason. So this started most recently, and this law has been on the books for years, but most recently there's a small town, Benton Harbor, and it is like 99.95% black, and it's been that way for a long, long time. And around the turn of the last century, you know, 1900, There was a very wealthy family there, and they bequeathed all this parkland to the black residents of Benton Harbor. So, you know, we all know the state of Michigan. What's going on financially in Benton Harbor is not anything that's not going on anywhere else. They decided to appoint an emergency manager, again, keeping with, you know, not out of the realm of stuff they don't do. But the twist is that this particular new governor, the new Republican governor of Michigan, appointed this person to be the emergency manager. And what this particular person did was go in, relieve the council of their duties. They're still a council, but they have no power. Anything they want to vote on, he overrides. He began selling off everything, even tried to sell a radio station on eBay. And the twist is there is a consortium that wants to build riverfront property, a riverfront golf course in Benton Harbor. So, and they've been trying to do this for years. So this particular emergency manager is in cahoots with them, the consortium that wants to do this. So they're selling off all the pieces of the city. They're not allowing the council to have any say in anything, nor the residents. And the residents are being kicked out. And it's being turned into a posh golf resort. And this is being done just this side of legal with the full blessing of the governor. And what's come to light recently is several things. One, they're trying it in several Michigan cities, and these cities are predominantly black. And, yes, they have fiscal issues, but, you know, so do most of the cities in Michigan. Secondly, the people got together to they collected signatures to get a referendum on the ballot to stop the emergency manager from what he was doing. Now, here's where it gets really funky. So the canvassing board who looks at the signatures and says, okay, these are all valid, it's two Republicans and two Democrats. The two Democrats said, yes, there are enough valid signatures, let's move through. The two Republicans said, you know what, the font size on the petitions is too small, so we're going to kick all these out. So they're like 10-point font instead of 11-point font. Now, the people who brought the font size challenge have their office and are part of the same, quote-unquote, nonprofit group that one of the Republican canvassers is in charge of. So basically, the Republican canvasser voted no on his own initiative, and there's nothing anybody can do about it. So now this land is going to go through and just be snatched. And I just don't understand. I want Michigan to tell me what the hell is going on. I have never seen anything so blatant in my life.
Well, that's because you haven't spent time in South Carolina. This is old news. I mean, the way they did it was different in South Carolina. And I have family down there. I wish they would call in and give their take on it. But Hilton Head, South Carolina, was designated land that former slaves were given after Reconstruction. And for all intents and purposes, it was free land. The families only had to pay taxes on the land to maintain it, to keep it. And the government in South Carolina did all kinds of crazy things to up the price of up the taxes on that land. And these people were paying like maybe $75 to $100 a year for estate taxes, and then those taxes went up to $10,000, $12,000, $13,000 a year. And we're talking very low-income people, and they lost that land. They couldn't maintain. They couldn't pay that tax on that land. And now Hilton Head and Myrtle Beach, those areas down south are very plush, very nice golf courses. It's an old move. You know, we're talking about a country that has a history of getting what they want, how they want, regardless of who's in power, what political parties in power. One of the things I found that was interesting about this story is the original emergency manager that was assigned to handle this came up with some formula that said even if he fired everyone, removed every service from the state, from the city, fired everyone, teachers, firemen, policemen, everything up and down the line, still wouldn't be enough money to pay off the debt in the city, so he threw his hands up and walked away from it. Was replaced.
I mean, that's because Michigan is in dire straits. I mean, what? I think they have 16% unemployment. You know, I think that's down from like 19%. I'm just pulling them around my butt. Don't even quote me on that. It's high. There's no money to be.
At a high butt?
I hate you. No, it's not. I hate you.
Heard it. Ed, did you hear that? I heard her say she had a high butt.
That's funny. But, you know, like Yale said, this really is old news. I mean, this is what the recent Supreme, a couple years ago now, the Supreme Court decision was, you know, concerning eminent domain. And it was pretty interesting, you know, that the conservatives were really up in arms about it. And yet with Michigan, I haven't heard a thing going on. And, you know, they've done this before. In Maryland, there's an area called Crownsville. That's near the waterfront. Well, Crownsville used to be run down, but now it's going upscale, and they've actually closed in, I guess, for lack of better terms, an insane asylum that's in Crownsville. Well, Crownsville was an area where free slaves settled, and it's gentrifying right now. I mean, some of it was some of the land was taken by eminent domain, but right now it's going the natural route with older people selling and, you know, developers coming in. But, you know, in Maryland, Martin O'Malley was infamous for doing that in Baltimore. You know, they snatched land, essentially put some businesses out of business, and those that they couldn't, they moved them just so he can, you know, build what a little in biopark in Baltimore, and, you know, pretty much, you know, really, to me, harmed a lot of people. And unfortunately, it's nothing new, and it's something to get mad about, but it's interesting that because it's Michigan with a Republican governor, you know, the Republican civil libertarians aren't saying anything. And I guess right now with the presidential election happening, anything goes, because I don't even hear the libertarians fighting this one.
Well, I'm going to fight it. I don't know how.
Well, you could take your high butt to Michigan and...
And burn my bra? Yeah, do it. Do it. So, real quick, we have a caller from the 443 area. See if they want to weigh in. Hi, caller. Did you want to add anything?
No, I was just listening to the show. Sitting
okay.
Here in total agreement. You know, I've heard all about the eminent domain and what's going on in Michigan. And, you know, Mr. Beverly and I, we've had a lot of conversations about this, and I really get pissed off at my people because they don't pay attention until it's too late.
This sounds like Sandra.
Yes, it is.
And Sandra knows that this is going to come off bad initially, but let me fix it. Sandra should know about Crownsville very well, right? Because it's in Annapolis. It's near the area where you're from, correct?
Yes, yes, yes. My mother used to work at Crownsville years ago.
Okay.
Yeah, my
okay.
uncle used to work there, and a friend's father used to work there as well.
Right. So, yeah, it's the black people and Michigan, Michigan, Wisconsin, I don't feel sorry for the people in Michigan and Wisconsin because they didn't come out and vote. They didn't. They ended up with the guy in Wisconsin, Ryan, Paul Ryan, who wants to get rid of all of the teachers. Like, the teachers and the civil servants are the ones that created all of this debt in Wisconsin and doesn't want to help any of them. And then the same people that voted him in office are the same ones he's trying to get out of it, take away their jobs.
Governor Walker.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's interesting too. I think it's, you know, what do they call it, the tail wagging the dog.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
or
chicken
you can buy your own petard is what it is.
Yeah, I don't understand what is now so. And Ed, maybe you can help me with this. Why is there an attack on civil servants by the right? I understand that no one is happy with the heavy burden that the public sector, the public jobs have with these pension plans that, you know, have bankrupt some cities. But why are we attacking, why are we going after teachers? Why are we going after police departments, policemen, firemen? These are the jobs that, you know, I'm 37 plus a few more years, and that we're going to leave it at that. But I remember as a child, everyone wanted to be a policeman or a fireman or a teacher, or, you know, those were the jobs that we were directed to. You know, those were jobs, those were positions and occupations that were looked up to by certain standards. And now, you know, they don't pay anything. Yeah, I come from a family, a lot of teachers in my family. And teaching job, you're not going to get rich. No one says, I'm going to become a teacher so I can be a millionaire like Bill Gates.
It's something.
Why is there this war on civil servant jobs?
It's something I don't quite understand. I think mainly in the case of teachers, it's mainly because, you know, the teachers' unions back Democrats, so they have to go after that union and crush it so that there's no mandatory financial, you know, there's
mm-hmm.
no financial backing there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for civil servants, I just don't quite understand. There was a report that's been publicized that said that, you know, when you compare the current federal civil service workers to equivalent jobs in the private sector, that they make more. Now, I know a lot of people in the federal government, and I know that it just doesn't seem to be the case. I think, you know, the authors of the report did a lot of oversimplifying because from what I understand, you know, the education requirement, the education difference between the public and the private sectors for some jobs is quite different, where it's actually higher in the government than in the private sector, and you would expect that higher educated pretty much means, you know, more money. But, you know, it's something I'm not quite sure of. Even Giuliani in New York, you know, he got into office basically by bashing Dinkins, you know, and when with the support of the police, who chanted in a rally, who were calling Dinkins the N-word and gorilla and all of this nonsense. And then his last years turned around and went to war against the NYPD, you know, to cut salaries and some other things, and, you know, cut pensions or whatever. I don't fully understand it, except that maybe it's an easy target. You know,
yeah, it's an easy target. I see that, but I also see, like I said, the you know, going after the pensions, and the pensions are a bad problem that doesn't have an easy fix. I understand that, and you know, like I said, I have a lot of teachers in my family. A lot of my aunts and cousins taught and retired as teachers, and they, you know, you put money into that program, you expect to get money out. To retire and live the rest of your days on. But just some of, just like you said, the vilification of these people is beyond me. And Scott Walker in Wisconsin, it's like I hope I don't offend any of the retarded people listening, which would be part of my family and some of Kamal's, but it's like the retarded pit bull. It's bitten the wrong thing and won't let go. If you know the history of Giuliani, he was a prosecutor that helped take down a lot of the five mafia heads of the five mafia families, and he was firmly in the corner and had the police and had the police backing him. I mean, he did some good things in New York back in the 70s, and then to turn against them, especially after 9/11, when he was standing out there and he had his arms around survivors and the firemen and policemen, and now just, you know, it's amazing to me. Giuliani is one of the first people that called Mitt Romney a flip-flopper and never had a solid stance on any issue, and he's flipped on not as severely as Romney, but just as much as Romney.
I agree. You know, I agree.
Okay, so, with that, I think we want to thank Ed for his valuable input and let him know that he is more than welcome to stop by anytime.
Ed can stick around. Ed can stick around.
Yeah,
you can stick around.
You can stick around.
Okay.
But we're gonna move over to Deesha. Now, you know, some of us, you know, are born with sisters. I was, but I don't want her. The sister that I've always wanted is Deesha. If I could choose one, it would be her. And Deesha, who I'm going to bring on, is, as Yale said at the top of the hour, she's really an expert on co-parenting. You know, her life's mission is children first. And in that, you know, working with parents who are not able to live together as a couple, still learn how to parent in the best interest of their children. Hi, Deesha.
Hello, everybody.
How
Hi,
you
Deesha,
doing?
Welcome.
I'm good. Okay, Kamal, you made me cry before I even get on the air. And
I didn't say anything you don't already know.
Well, you know what? I am your sister because you remember your mom adopted me. Duh.
That's true. Well,
wait a minute.
I picked you.
Can I interject here for a second?
No, you may not yell Theodore Beverly.
I love this love fest, but I have to ask, Deesha, isn't Kamal's mom the best?
You know what? I've only met her by phone, but she called me some years ago right after my mom passed, and she was like, look, don't be moping around. You know you have somewhere to be anytime you want to be there. So, yes, she is the absolute best.
Yes. She's adopted me, too, much to the chagrin of Kamal. But she's a wonderful lady, a wonderful lady. And just so we keep it all real in interest of full disclosure, I wrote Kamal's intro for you, Deesha.
See, he already acts like a bratty brother.
See, he knows because I'm a writer that that's going to give him points and stuff like that.
And that's all it is. That's all it is. That's why I told him to just shush it over there because he was getting ready to ask for a Kamal and Deesha sandwich. I know that was coming next.
No. An appetizer would be good, you know, with some hot sauce, maybe a little blue cheese.
You need to stay away from blue cheese with your lactose intolerance self. Keep way
Uh-oh.
Over there.
But my butt's not high. Anyway. Deesha, I don't know if you were listening in at that point, but we've all...
Yes. I was like, what have I gotten myself into when I heard that?
Right. I presented it. I said, you know, we're professional. You know, we'll talk about what you need to talk about, and we'll keep it above board. And we're talking about butts and fart jokes. Yay!
Hey. Rude selves. So, Deesha, talk to us. Tell us about your book, your upcoming book, and your work.
Okay. The book is called Co-Parenting 101, Helping Your Children Thrive After Divorce, and it's going to come out in the spring of next year, and our publisher is New Harbinger Publications. Excuse me, and a little shout-out to them. They are a self-help book publisher, and they typically publish books written by clinicians, you know, people with letters behind their names, but they really embrace the idea of a co-parenting book written by co-parents. And our book, and when I say our, I'm referring to my co-author, who is also my co-parent, and he is also my ex-husband, Michael Thomas. And we are writing this book as hopefully a guidebook and some encouragement to others who are co-parenting as we are after divorce or after another breakup. And our work is to really change what we see as sort of some cultural assumptions about post-divorce parenting or about co-parenting in general, where there has to be this sort of acrimony and this animosity between people after a breakup, which is, you know, typical, it's common, it's not unusual. But the difference is that when there's a breakup with kids involved, the intimate partnership is over, but there's still a partnership there, ideally, in the best interest of kids, for there to be a parenting partnership. And so it's really challenging for people to make that transition and to, you know, see those two relationships as separate, you know, the old intimate relationship dead and gone, and then the new relationship that's born when you become a co-parent. And so we hope that our work on our website and through social media and then through our book will just guide and encourage people to really serve their kids and love their kids more than they hate their ex, and work together on their children's behalf.
Well, Deesha, tell us what got you interested. I mean, obviously there was an interest there before, but what got you so fired up for this subject?
Well, you know, we didn't have any resources. I mean, there are obviously books out there, but when Mike and I split up, you know, there was one book that we consulted, but there was a lot that we had to sort of work through ourselves. We had to do our own self-care, our own healing, our own, you know, hits and misses and, you know, making some mistakes and some emails with some F-bombs and a lot of stuff we had to go through. But one thing that we never did was subject our kids to that. Never use our kids as weapons, and we always recognize the importance of each other in our children's lives. Like, that would never change, that we honor each other as parents regardless of the nature of how we were getting along. And so, you know, most people who knew us didn't know about all the behind-the-scenes drama. All they could see is that we were taking really good care of our kids. And so people would say things like, you guys are the poster children for divorce. And we always say, you know, we don't want to be the poster children for divorce. You know, nobody wants to be. But if you do divorce, there's a way that, you know, divorce is a trauma regardless. So I'm not going to try and soft pedal and say that, you know, there's a good way to make it such that your kids won't feel this impact. But kids do feel it. But you can commit to sparing them the adult drama and the conflict between the adults as much as possible. That is a commitment that we believe that everyone should make. So we made that commitment, and people noticed, and people would say things like, you guys should write a book. And this was within the first year or so of us separating and divorcing, and we would still meet periodically, you know, over coffee or something to talk about the kids or whatever. It was very formal at that time. And Mike was like, you know, people are saying, you know, we should write a book. We should write a book. And because he's a banker and I'm a writer, that meant, you know, he should get on that. So I started looking into, you know, well, what do you, you know, how do you write a book on a subject like this? And the first thing we wanted to do was find out, well, what do people need to know? You know, we knew our process. We didn't know a lot of the people personally who had been divorced and were co-parenting. And so we just sort of hung our little shingle out and said, you know, tell us your stories. And we invited co-parents to tell us their stories. And we sort of saw our site as, well, here's a place where you can read some interesting articles from other places. Here's what works in our family. Here's how we handle vacations. We thought we could help people by sharing tips and things like that. But it ended up being a real education for us because we learned about the kinds of things people were really dealing with in their co-parenting situations. We didn't even think about, okay, people are not only dealing with each other, what about a new partner? Now, granted, you know, ultimately each of us remarried and so forth, but we were confronted with that with other people's stories before we ourselves were introducing our kids to new partners and things like that. So we got a real education in the kinds of things that people were dealing with. You know, how do you co-parent after domestic violence? How do you co-parent with someone who's mentally ill? How do you co-parent with somebody who won't honor the parenting agreement? So as people approached us with these subjects, we just expanded our network. We don't have all the answers, so we started connecting with other co-parents, with therapists and lawyers. We use social media a lot to build the network. Through our radio show, and just started connecting people with resources, and then, you know, really being a resource ourselves as we became more knowledgeable. So it started with what we were doing in our own families and thinking that, you know, we could help other people, and then realizing that we could help other people by connecting them not just to us but to each other on our Facebook group. We have, you know, co-parents helping each other. So it really just came organically out of our personal experience.
Well, it's, you know, I've lived this. I mean, I don't mind explaining and telling people. I have a son who's 12 years old, loved this young man to death. He's a great kid. His mother and I were not married, and we faced challenges dealing with things. He has some health issues, and in a lot of ways, I believe his mother uses his health problems as a way to show that she is in control. And there's a it really works against, in my opinion, sometimes the best interest of the child. Yes, mm-hmm. his health is paramount for both of us, but she tries to lord over the fact that she has more access to more information about what's going on with him and uses that as a control mechanism. And I think it's unhealthy for the my son going forward. And we've had incidences where it's caused him stress.
Mm-hmm.
He changed schools 2 years ago, and she didn't tell me. Not only did she not tell me, she told him not to tell me.
Oh, man.
And it conflicted him. It conflicted him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this child, from the very beginning, that he start comprehending things, never be afraid to tell your dad anything.
Right, right.
And if any person tells you something and says, whatever you do, don't tell your mother, don't tell your father, don't tell your parents, then you know you need to tell us. And if anyone says, don't tell your dad, you know you need to tell me. So here he has his mother telling him not to tell me.
Right.
And then he was 10 years old, it messed with his head. I know it messed with his head.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And I want to get her a copy of your book for Christmas. Unfortunately, I don't want to wrap it. I want to, you know, deliver it FedEx through the window. But that's just
well, you know, the funny thing
is, I don't
is
think that's good co-parenting.
They can have information. It's just what they do with it. And I remember when we were doing some research when we were writing our book proposal, we were reading about this one book on co-parenting. And in Amazon, in the reviews, the guy was like, you know, I think that, you know, this book is great, but it seems like every time I try one of these tactics, you know, she comes up with something else. She's like a super virus. And that just really struck me. And at the end of the day, you know, and I certainly want to sell our book, but ultimately our message is you can only control yourself. And that control, one of the first things you said is that she likes to control. And when you have somebody who's trying to control the situation, manipulate the situation, there is a certain piece for the parent and also the child when you stand down. And the trick is knowing when to stand up and when to stand down. And realize that, you know, you can't control this person, you know, when they won't play by the rules, when they keep up in the stakes, when they do the letter of the law but not the spirit and all of that. And ultimately, you know, you can control your reactions. You can control your responses. You can control your time with your child. And, you know, and having the peace that comes with this is the part that I can control because I can't control, you know, this other person. But that doesn't mean it's not frustrating. So I'm not saying, you know, that you should be all zen about it because, you know, we have our moments. And people don't understand that Mike and I at times, you know, have our moments as well. But at the end of the day, you know, remember she's struggling with the same thing because, you know, even though she exerts a lot of control, ultimately she can't control you completely. And so, you know, my hope is that she would stand down as well and accept that, you know, your son is in your care and you're very capable, you know.
And that's where it gets tricky because it's so obvious that no matter what she does to either drive a wedge or to separate
mm-hmm.
That she's in more control. My son is my son, and my son
mm-hmm.
knows I would kill and or die for him. And
mm-hmm.
he'll tell anybody at any given time I'm his best buddy. And I know
right.
that kind of grates at her because she'll do things, and we could do a whole show on the things that I've been through with this woman.
Right.
But she'll do things, and he'll still say, my dad's my best friend.
Mm-hmm.
And it grates her, and she acts out on it. She probably tries to say she doesn't, but she acts out on it. But I don't want it to be about me. We got some callers on the line. I see Sandra's back. Sandra, you want to add anything to this? I know you have your own show, and everyone listening, Sandra has an excellent show on Blog Talk Radio about relationships, and I've listened to a show. We've been friends for years. Actually, we became friends because of what she does talking about relationships.
Mm-hmm.
Her opinion on this.
Well, you know, I'm now dating a man who has a son, and I don't understand women. I don't want to get out on all of the women because I hear that men do it too, but how much of the control issue is the fact that he no longer wants her?
Yeah, a lot of times people can, you know, the co-parenting situation will be going along smoothly, and boom, all of a sudden, if you introduce a new partner, all hell breaks loose. And even before that, there are people that they haven't resolved those lingering feelings, and they can't understand, I'm so angry at this person, or I'm so hurt, or I'm so disappointed, but still those that desire and those romantic feelings, they die hard because instead of letting them riding it out, being honest about it, and then working through it, they fight it, they fight it, they fight it, and the more, you know, they might have those, you know, feelings of regret or longing or whatever, then they act out to try and, you know, overcompensate. So I don't know, you know, Yale's ex, but that's certainly something that is very, very common, that people just never get over the breakup. And instead of just letting that be separate and focus on their kids, they use the kids as a whole new battleground to keep grinding that axe.
Yeah, and heaven forbid my son likes whoever I'm seeing. You know,
you have a whole other set of issues you have to deal with.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And Sandra knows I was in a recent relationship that ended a couple of years ago. And I apologize, the Kamal sexy siren's going off again. relationship. And,
God, I hate you.
That young lady, that was the high butt alarm. That lady had a daughter who I wouldn't say I doted over, but I treated her as if she were my own. And the closer I tried to get with her, to her, be her buddy, be someone she could rely on, the more she resented it and the more she acted out. It was ridiculous. This child.
The mother, the daughter, or your ex?
The daughter. You know who I'm talking about. The daughter treated me like I spit in her coffee. And I didn't trust her cooking or doing anything around because I know she was spitting in my food. I know. I know I probably had some cream of wheat with some extra creamy in it sometimes, but it was weird. And the thing that really bothered me is the mother never took control of this situation and tried to bring her daughter in line. I would never hurt this child. I would never do anything to harm this child. I defended her in front of a coach she had. She tried to do sports in high school. And I went and told her coach, look, I don't appreciate how you're treating this girl. You know, you need to step up and be a coach and not resent the fact that the girl has some talent. Nurture that talent. She may not be a superstar, but nurture the talent. But the more I did, the more she drove it in there. And the mother just never said, look, let me sit you a little behind down and straighten you out on what it takes to be in a relationship and know that your mother's happy. And this is, you know, what you're doing is driving the wedge between my happiness and us going forward, hopefully as a family. And it was a deciding factor in why that relationship ended.
Well, let me ask you this: Do you have any insight on how to navigate that when the child is resisting? You know, maybe wanting mommy and daddy to get back together and doing, you know, something from the Lifetime Network every weekend.
I mean, this is devil's advocate. I don't, you know, because I don't know the situation. I don't know the little girl, but I would wonder how many men has she met that her mother has dated. I mean, I'm not disparaging your ex's character or anything. It's just a fair question, I think, because one problem is kids can resist when, you know what, the last guy that was here, I was nice to him or I liked him or I got comfortable with him, and he left. And so it's tricky when kids are introduced to a lot of people or if they haven't dealt with their parents' breakup. I don't know the relationship between the mom, dad, and the child and what kind of co-parenting is happening there. So she's bringing her stuff to bear on the relationship. And, you know, so whatever's going on with her has to be addressed. I don't think it's as simple as, your mom wants to be happy. You really have to look and see, well, what happened when her parents broke up? How did she handle that? Did she get help? Did she get support? Did she act out? How did she feel about her dad dating? Did her dad just walk away? Did her mom push her dad? I mean, there are so many factors that influence how she's going to interact with you. You know, are you guy number two? Are you guy number 22?
Well, I think,
I don't have any kids.
Go ahead, Sandra.
I don't have any kids, but my mother and father, they have this blended relationship. My mother had three kids when she met him before she had myself and my sister. And they were always on one accord. And I don't see that with people our age. Don't say this to my child. Don't do this to my child. Don't look at them sideways. You can't say anything to these kids nowadays. I don't think that they have the same parenting style. And I'm not saying that they should, but when you bring your families, you have to have one accord. The husband has to be in agreement if the wife is the step-parent and vice versa. You have to back each other up. And when the children know that they can divide you, they will.
Oh, you know what? I lived that growing up.
And that's your fault.
And that was a problem growing up. But you're right. You're absolutely right. Your parents did it right. They got on one accord. Now, we don't
know
what happened with when the doors were shut. They may have had some knockdown dragouts about that little one, Sandra, and her throwing stuff against the wall. But you all never saw that. You all never had to experience that.
No, not at all. I remember my father saying, when my brother said to him, he was 11 years old, and he looked at him and he was like, "I'm not your father. You're not my father." And my father said he dropped him. He put his fist, slammed in his chest, and dropped him to the ground, took the wind out of him. Never had another problem with him since. And my mother didn't say a word because she said he was clothing him, he was feeding him, and he was housing him.
And he had every right. He had every right.
But you can't.
And he wasn't hurting the child. He wasn't harming the child. That's the problem we have today. You got to worry about who you bring around your children. Look, I got a caller that's been on here for a while, calling from the 443 area code. Not you, Sandra. Another 443 area code. Carla, do you have anything you want to add? Want to say?
Yes. Hi, my name is Miriam Bryce, and hello.
Hi, Miriam.
Yes. How are you? Yeah, I got married because my husband wanted to be a father to my son. My husband doesn't have any children. I have three. And my son was, the road he was going down, this was, you know, kindergarten and first grade, you know, cutting school at first grade and kindergarten and leaving class and, you know, hurting other students and everything. And his thing was, I want to be a father to your son. You know, let's get married. A situation had happened. The police had got involved, and he got arrested.
In kindergarten?
No, I'm talking about my son was cutting school and cutting
classes.
Oh,
okay, but he was out of kindergarten.
First grade and in kindergarten. When my son was in kindergarten, he was in first grade, he was cutting school and cutting classes.
Gotcha.
And hurting other children, and then the situation had happened. My soon-to-be husband had got arrested. I'm going down to pick him up at jail, and I'm saying, "Oh Lord, this man is gonna leave me and say you and your kids, you know, just bye." But he said, "You know, I want to be a father to your son." He said, "Let's get married." He said, "I want to teach him how, you know, to grow up to be a man," and that's how we got married. So it is possible to have that, you know, relationship. Now, to this day, they get along, but my son still wants to do his own thing.
Mm-hmm.
But he knows that's dad. He knows him as dad. Not his biological, you know, that's not his biological father, but he knows him as dad.
How long have you guys been married?
June, it'll be 15 years.
Congratulations. Congratulations.
Thank you. And my son, he'll be 22 in August.
Okay. Does he know his biological father?
No, not really.
Okay.
No, his biological father didn't want to be involved.
We see that a lot, not only in our community, but in all communities.
But he's involved with his uncle, his father's brothers and their sons,
mm-hmm.
but just not his, you know, his father's, you know, immediate family. But his brothers, his father's, his biological father's brothers, they're involved with him. But
you know, he may still feel a sense of resentment.
Oh, he does.
Over the abandonment, because that's something that people just, they I hate to say it, they need therapy, but they still have to deal with that issue of abandonment, especially if this man has gone on to father other children and is being a father to them.
Right. Right. Deisha, have you come across situations like this, and how, what's your advice?
In terms of when the father has been absent?
No, when the, I can't imagine this is unique, but the father is absent, but the father's family is not absent.
Well, that was pretty much my existence. I mean, my father wasn't fully absent, but I was more engaged with my father's parents and my uncles and aunts and my grandparents and my father. You know, I would get picked up by my dad and dropped off. So, you know, it is tough because there's no substitute for that relationship because there's a tie severed. There are those feelings of rejection and abandonment and those sorts of things. It's hard, too, because if it works like with my situation where my mom and my grandparents and everybody got along and it was there was no drama, but I'm thinking of one co-parenting situation I know of where, you know, the dad's sort of on the outs and he's not reliable and all these other things, and the grandparents want to step up and want to assert, and mom is like, hold up, you know, this is going to be, you know, I'm still in charge here. And so when there's not a good relationship between the parent who is there and the other, you know, the other side of the family and grandparents, that's a problem because they can feel the same way, you know, maybe a little apologetic for how this other person is behaving, and they want to just sort of assert, step in, and they can't replace the father, you know. And then the mom might want to do some gatekeeping and you know, protecting or overprotecting, and then it gets really, really tricky. And at the end of the day, there needs to be respect. There needs to be respect for the parent as the parent, and respect that, you know what, the child has a right to have a relationship with, you know, the other side of the family. And, you know, instead of people sort of making demands and all of that, communicate, work it out, talk about it, set up a schedule, because the children, you know, they need the consistency, not I want to get him this weekend, you know, without notice, and not the answer always being no. You know, come up with a time that works for everybody. But usually, you know, everybody's trying to claim and grab claim to the child, like possession, and, you know, everybody loses, but most especially the child when that happens. And then at the end of the day, you still have a child who's maybe at grandma and grandpa's or with their uncle or whoever, still longing for the other parent that's not around. And so that does complicate things because that issue still hasn't been addressed.
Well, you know, Deisha, you sound like you're like the female me. When you were a kid, my father did the same thing. He would pick me up on weekends and drop me off at his parents' house, and there were times he'd bring me home, but usually I spent the weekend with my grandparents and my aunt and had a great time. I was fine with it because, you know, my father was a little weird, but I mean, the Beverleys are my family. I'm a Beverly, but I don't know my biological father that well, and I think my mother and my stepfather, Walt Carr, for the things they did to make sure I was okay. You know, they really stepped up, and you know, no one ever badmouthed my father in front of me. But as I got older, I saw some of the things that he did not do, and I've said on any number of occasions. I'm a better father. I'm a good father today because of the lessons I learned from the things my father didn't do.
Right.
Can I ask a question? Because I didn't have that experience. I had the total opposite experience. I'm a daddy's girl. Still am. And, what I want to know is, because I look at the fact, like, my mother's mother did not raise her. She was raised by her father. And he raised 11 children.
Gee.
Okay. Well, he raised 10. She took the youngest boy she raised, but the other 10 he had to raise. And when she got sick, none of the kids wanted to take her in. And people couldn't understand it, but I, in a way, understood it. She didn't raise them. So why should they be obligated to take care of her?
Well, you know us, because we like that.
And it's really
mama,
sad when you see somebody 80-some years old roaming from home to home because they didn't build anything. In 80 years on Earth, she owned shit. Excuse my French. Nothing.
Oh, goodness.
Nothing. And when she died, they all had to pitch in and pay for everything. And I look at my nephews, whose father is in the nail white, but who has gone on to remarry and have children. I'm like, I can see that they have this resentment, especially the youngest one. He wants nothing at all to do with them. I said, if this man gets sick, how are they going to treat him? It's going to be interesting to see how they're going to treat him, because boys are different than girls.
I've heard that. I've heard there's a difference between boys
mm-hmm.
and girls.
Mm-hmm. Let me interrupt real quick. We have another caller who's been on hold for a while, so let me bring them in. Hi, caller. Did you have a question for us?
No. This is Sean. I was just calling in. Miss Dacia, she posted that she would be on the show, and I'm really enjoying the discussion right now.
Hey, Sean.
Well, we're glad that you're enjoying it. So, Dacia, in honor of Sean, real quick, do you have like a top 10 do's and don'ts for our listeners in terms of co-parenting?
Okay, I have some do's and don'ts. You guys have to keep count though, because I don't have an example.
I'll keep count because I know Kamal only has 9 fingers, so that would be. Kind of
you know what? I'm gonna reach through the phone.
Okay, so one of the big ones is not bad mouthing the other parent. That's a big one. And that doesn't mean you have to be fake or, you know, say things you don't mean. But, it also means don't say things around your kids, like to somebody else. You know, kids overhear so much when you're just sitting on the phone. And, you know, I just shudder to think the kids who have heard their parents call each other all kinds of names while they're, you know, just talking to somebody else on the phone and just overhearing the name calling and stuff. And one of the best quotes I've heard, and I don't remember the source, but somebody said, you know, when you talk badly about your ex, you're basically saying to your child, honey, I love you, but you're 50% jackass. And you would never say that to your child. But
or 100%, you know, jackass. If the kid,
you know,
because
essentially,
looks like the
you know, they're half of the other
hey,
person.
God, yeah, we know that one.
I'm sorry?
I said we
oh,
know
said
that in our community. We know that. I believe that was Ed that said you're 100% jackass because you look like
you'll be. Yeah, if when the kid looks like the parent, that's your bad mouthing. Then and the kid knows it. You know, then the kid feels it's like, wow. You know, they're talking about me, just not 50%.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but
right. 100%. And like, okay, if this person is so bad, but I love them. What you know, is it okay for me to love them? And then you know, yeah, you were talking about that those feelings of being conflicted. But you know, for your son. You know, it just creates, you know, that internal conflict. And speaking of conflict, another one, I'd say number 2, resolve conflicts, issues, whatever, between the adults without putting the kids in the middle. And so your focus should be on your children in terms of your co-parenting partnership. They're the only reason you're really interacting with this person anymore, but kids shouldn't be in the middle. They should not be used as messengers. The adults need to deal with adult things and not burden their kids with it. And that includes things like, you know, it's not just bad mouthing, but eye rolling or, you know, how come your dad has to always bring you back late? You know, even things like that, which is a legitimate concern, but, you know, that's for adult conversation. So not putting kids in the middle. And the conversation for kids is always, you know what, your mom and I, your dad and I, you know, we're working together because we both care about you and we both want to take care of you and, you know, let us worry about the grown-up problems. You don't worry about that. The other one is boundaries. Some of the dating stuff that we were talking about would not be an issue if people just stayed in their own lane. Unless your child is being harmed, you have no say, no control, no right over whether or not they are introduced to a new partner. People don't want to hear that. And it's our fear, you know, I don't want this other woman around my kids, you know, am I going to be replaced or, you know, whatever the fears are, we just have to work on that as grown-ups, you know, pull up the big girl panties, pull up the big boy boxers and deal with the fact that there's this other person around your kid. And it might drive you nuts, but unless there's some harm or potential for harm that you can document, there's not a lot you can do. Some co-parents have agreements, you know, the child can't meet anyone unless you've been dating them for X amount of time. The child can't be present for overnight you know, with overnight guests, things like that, you can put limitations on. But just that general, you know, well, I don't like him or I don't like her, or, you know, if you are, you're not going to be able to see the child if your girlfriend's around. That's one we hear a lot with, unfortunately, women in particular, trying to limit men's access to their children once the man is involved in a new relationship. So stay in your lane, respect the boundaries of other people's personal lives. It goes without saying, communicate, but the communication breakdowns are very common, and that's why the co-parenting often just falls into chaos, because people don't communicate or won't communicate regularly with things having to do with their kids. Kids want their parents to know, both of them, what's going on with their in their lives and what they need. So you're not doing it to appease this other person. You're doing it because it's good for your kids. Remember that your kids are always watching. What is it that you want to teach them? So if the minute something happens, you fly off the handle and start calling names and making threats and accusations, that's how you're teaching your child to deal with conflict. So don't be surprised when they go to school and act that way. So be a good role model is another one. Let's see. Be consistent. And, again, that's a tough one because people have different parenting styles, different house rules, to the extent that they're the same across households. It's a good thing. So we say, instead of striving for everything being exactly the same, the exact number of hours of TV or whatever it is, just try and be consistent so that it's not like a free-for-all at one house and then, you know, rules and structure at the other house, because it makes it very confusing for kids, and it also makes it harder on the parent who's the disciplinarian if the other parent is, you know, just fun time Charlie. I don't know. Who's keeping count?
You are at six. I got six.
Oh, I got seven.
I had 32.
I didn't count.
All right, here's one. And people, you know, we were talking about parenting, old school parenting. Maybe this is new school, but the bottom line is this. Kids have a right to have a relationship with both parents. And I should caveat that, both fit and willing parents. Some parents have been found to be unfit, but even those parents might have supervised access, parenting time access to their children. Some people don't want to be parents, you know, but if parents are fit and willing, children have a right to have a relationship with them. So it's not up to the whim of somebody who may have, you know, sole or primary physical custody to sort of restrict access and use that control mechanism, because your child has a right to have a relationship with that other person. I would say, let's talk about a little bit about the dating one. Do not, please, please expose your children to what we call the revolving door of your dating life, which is, you know, everybody you date does not have to meet your kids.
Right.
And for kids, it's difficult to meet someone. You're already conflicted because this is a new partner and, you know, your parents aren't together and whatever else the child is dealing with, and then here's this new person, and how long are they going to stick around, because then I know there's going to be another one and another one. So if kids can be spared that, then when you are ready to have a relationship and settle down and introduce someone as a future step-parent, you know, you've done your homework. And I think Lysandra earlier was talking about how her parents did it, where they were one accord. And I'm remarried now, and my husband and I don't always agree on everything, but we are committed to having a united front. We have four girls between the two of us. And, you know,
my heart
we do have conversations. But to them, it's a united front. But we laid the groundwork in that, you know, we dated for over a year before our kids ever met us or the other set of kids or anything like that. You know, so we didn't rush into anything. And our kids, the only people they ever met were the people that ended up being their step-parents. And I'm not saying that that has to be the case for everybody, that, you know, but, you know, I think it benefited them that when they finally did meet someone, we were essentially saying, you know what, this person is special to me, but so are you. You're so special that I don't let just anybody meet you. Only somebody who's super special gets to meet you. And that's how, when you're dating and kids know you're dating, well, how come I can't meet them? Or who are you going out with? Well, it's because, you know, I want to make sure that this is a person who deserves to meet you, who's special enough to meet you and be a part of your life. So keeping them out of the revolving door of your dating life, is that 8?
That's 10.
I think it's 9. Actually, I really think that's 9.
Oh,
I got a
9.
Well, 9.
Yeah, but that last one is a big one. And, you know, for those who are single, I looking back on it now, because I've gone through, I guess, the co-parenting thing, you know, is actually don't be afraid to interview the person you're dating to find out about
mm-hmm.
their parenting styles. Because if
mm-hmm.
your style is, if you're like me, more of a, you know, of a captain or, you know, a gunny sergeant, you know, and somebody else is really loosey-goosey and liberal, that's not going to work when you get together.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So basically what you're saying is a direct contradiction to Steve Harvey. I'm just joking.
I got a question. I do have a question, if I could still ask.
Because he said if you're dating somebody for 6 months and then the kids don't like them and you're not going to date them, you waste the 6 months of your life. I don't agree with it. But you have a lot of women who are taking his book as the Bible of dating, mating, and relationships. Okay.
Go ahead, Sean, you had a question?
Yeah, I did have a question. And really, I want to make a statement and a question. So I wanted to add one to the list, if I could, which is I feel like sometimes we co-parenting to recognize the other person is human and not everything is with a malicious intent. But a lot of times I see that when the other parent does something, the first thing we assume is, oh, they did it because they want to hold me up and they don't want me to have time with my child. Well, in actuality, you know, it's always hard being a parent, whoever got the child at that time. But then a question that I have for Daisha is, when discussing the needs of the child, often I run into this problem when I'm working with parents, is it okay to bring the other boyfriend, husband, girlfriend, wife around? In other words, I got to get with you because we have a child in common and we're talking about the needs of the child, but do I bring my new girlfriend and do I bring my new wife, even though they're in the background, so I need to be there.
Right. Well, a lot of times when people say I need to be there, that tells you everything you need to know. They want to be there for themselves, and they're not necessarily saying is what's best for the kids in this situation. And that's tough because if you do have a new partner, and a lot of women especially get this when they're the stepmom or soon-to-be stepmom, and it's like, you know what, I'm the one driving the kids, I'm the one doing all the shopping, I'm the one doing all this, and you need to tell me y'all are going to mediation and I can't come? Pretty much. You know, I mean, that sometimes the reality of what you sign up for is that you really leave, you know, the parenting to the parents, and a lot of times, you know, mediators or whatever don't necessarily allow a third party to come in. And I would say that if having that third party is going to be disruptive, and people know, you know what, I want to bring her because it's just going to piss my ex off or whatever, then the conversation isn't going to go anywhere. So you have to decide, what is it you really want to do? You want to make a point by bringing your boyfriend? You want to make a point by bringing your girlfriend? Or do you want to come to some agreement for your children? Because if it's going to be counterproductive to have that person there, then it's a moot point. And so I think the question is, why does that person need to be there? Why is it essential for them to be there for the parents to work out these details? And, you know, 9 times out of 10, it's not necessarily essential. You know, my husband went through a custody battle. He tried to get full custody of his girls. And, you know, he went through all the mediation and everything, court and all of that stuff, and I didn't attend a single thing. Do I support him as a co-parent? Absolutely. Do I do shopping, clothes shopping? Do I make a point? I do it all. And I didn't need to be at all of that stuff to support him as a co-parent. So it just depends on the person's motivation.
We're coming down to our last minute, and I want to thank everyone for calling in, listening in, and especially Deisha. I want to thank you and Sandra for your input. I think this show was great. Ed, I don't know where we fall politically because I'm one of the liberal-minded and think gun ownership is not a bad thing, but I would love to have all of you come back and talk on the show again. And of course, I always have to send a shout out to my good friend and great special co-host Kamal. Kamal, it's just a wonder working with you.
Oh, you like me. You really do.
No, really, but I have a thing for high butt women.
You know,
I want to quick.
That's true. Why can't you just say, Kamal, I love you, and leave it at that?
Kamal, I love your mom.
See?
Look, I'm also voting Miss Black Collegiate USA pageant is coming up